This week, we are rerunning the opera series with Desiree Mays that aired here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe in the spring. The opera about which we are speaking this morning corresponds to the one being performed tonight at the Santa Fe Opera, which is on the web at santafeopera.org. They can also be reached by phone at 505-986-5900. And I would like now to introduce Desiree Mays. She is a storyteller. She speaks all over the world on opera. She's the author of the book Opera Unveiled, which comes out every year to accompany the Santa Fe Opera season. She gives the preview lectures nightly at the Santa Fe Opera. Welcome, Desiree, to the Radio Cafe.
Hello, Mary Charlotte. It's good to be back.
It's good to have you. Now, today we're talking about The Pearl Fishers. That is an opera by Bizet.
Yes, it is. Georges Bizet, a Frenchman, of course. This opera premiered in Paris in 1863, and it's a very pretty opera, Mary Charlotte. It's set in an exotic place. At this time of writing of operas, exotic locales were very much the premier choice of most composers. In fact, Bizet said if you didn't have these exotic locales, something would be missing in the opera. So this particular one is set in pre-Christian Christian days in Ceylon, now Sri Lanka, of course, though the original setting was to be in Mexico, which really was a leap for a French composer. Exactly. Bizet was always very young because he died young. He had to get it all done before he was 37 years of age. But from birth, practically, from very, very young age, he clearly was an extraordinary musician. He could sight read. He was a virtuoso. He was a pianist. And he went to the conservatory years before anybody else.
Age
of nine. Yes, is that amazing?
The conservatory.
Yep.
We were playing with Legos.
Yeah, that's true. But there are still some child prodigies out there. You know, you listen to some of these programs, and there they are. I mean, the violinist, the pianist that we have today. So it is still possible. It would be terrible if we lost that ability, wouldn't it? It'd be sad. So he was very young, so when he got a start, and then won the great Prix de Rome, which is the biggest award of the time, which meant that the composer could go and study for 3 years in Rome, which he did. He struggled, though. This was a man who had tons of wonderful ideas as to what he would like to write about, but didn't always see them through. He lost the inspiration or something happened. It was a struggle. I mean, it was the creative process struggling. His mentor was Charles Gounod, and some of his earlier works smack a little bit of Gounod. You can hear that sound in his work. He did the orchestration for a number of Gounod's operas, and Gounod was always a wonderful supporter of the young Bizet. So it was hard for him to get started, and he has done a number of operas. Some are now coming back to light, but he's remembered in the main, of course, for Carmen. That was the great opera of Bizet. And the tragedy was that his operas were never really appreciated, even the great Carmen. And it was on the 33rd performance of Carmen that he died at the age of 37, disillusioned and disappointed, this young composer who wrote one of the greatest operas of all time. There's always that tragedy. And if you think that, you know, some of the great composers, Verdi and Wagner, did their greatest work after their mid-30s, what might have happened if Bizet had lived longer. So it wasn't to be. The other thing I think to know about Bizet is that he is French, and this is the French style. People say, well, how is that different to the Italian or the German? They're quite different and always have been. I think they reflect the sensibility of those peoples. The Italians are always wildly passionate. The French are more subtle. They believed in melody in their operas. There's a lot of melody in this very beautiful piece. They believed in beautiful singing, which is and is not bel canto. The voice has to be really beautiful. The notes have to be beautifully interpreted. The text was always very important. French theater was always one of the bright, shining stars of France through all its terrible history of wars. So the poetic meter of the text was very important. The music had to match that, whereas with other composers, it could be the other way around. The music would be written and the text had to fit the music. That didn't happen with French. So with the French sound, it's subtle and it's delicate. There can be a transparency to the sound. He was influenced by Debussy, Ravel. You hear some of this in the opera. It's not a piece where there's an aria and a recitative. The arias, the sort of the solo moments, flow very easily from the text. So it's a different style. There was always a ballet. The French insisted on ballets in their operas. In fact, that's one of the reasons Wagner came undone in Paris when he did Tannhäuser, because he had the nerve to put the ballet later than the French audience liked it, and they damned him for that. It was not good. So Bizet, it was a short life, but a very rich one. And this piece is really lovely. As I said, it is set in a salon. It's really a story based on a Hindu myth about the Brahma, the god of creation. There's a young girl, a virgin priestess, who is always veiled. She must be never seen. And her job is to pray for the pearlfishes. Once a year on this island, they go out and they harvest the pearls. And, of course, in those days, they didn't have the equipment, of course. They just...
No deep sea, no scuba,
stuff,
anything.
Nothing.
Yeah.
They just dived over the edge. And it was very dangerous. The fatalities were very high. So the idea of having a priestess who would just stand on the shore and pray for them to Brahma actually made good sense, both a practical and a spiritual point of view. So this is the setting. It's a lovely setting. And we should talk a little later about how the set in this production is done, because it's a very novel and I think an approach that works very well. So we're on the island and we meet the villagers, and they are preparing for the harvest. They choose one of their own, Zurga, who is the baritone, who is going to be their leader. And he says, I will lead you on one condition, that I have complete control. And they agree to this. And as the festivities get underway, as they're gearing up for this festival and the harvest, another man from another village appears. It is Nadir, who turns out to be Zurga's childhood friend. The two of them had been like brothers. But at some point, they had both fallen in love with the same priestess at another event.
Was she a priestess even then?
This was another priestess, yes. The young woman they'd both fallen in love with. And then, of course, fell out of love with one another because of it. Their friendship ceased and they went their separate ways until now, when they come back together and the two men sing the most beautiful duet of all time for a tenor and a baritone. As they come back together, they greet each other and they agree that they have put love behind them. They will not let a woman get in way of their friendship ever again. They're brothers, and they agree to this, and they sing this absolutely exquisite duet. Let me just sing you. No way I'm going to sing. I'm going to tell you the words for this. Au fond du temple saint, from the depths of the holy temple, decked with golden flowers, a woman appears. The kneeling crowd looks at her astonished and softly murmurs, behold, it is the goddess who rises out of the darkness and stretches her arms towards us. Her veil is raised, O vision, O dream, the crowd is on its knees. It is she, the goddess, most lovely and beautiful. So behind the voices of the two singers, you'll hear the chorus in this quite lovely duet that I imagine 99% of our listeners out there will actually recognize.
Dans l'ombre
indeed a beautiful duet.
Duet, yeah.
And I don't know if, I mean, I didn't know this piece until last year. I guess it's a famous piece, though.
Well, it's one of the hit songs, I suppose, from opera, like some of the Carmen pieces, you know. I mean, some of these we know from cartoons.
That's
you know, the
true.
Ride of the Valkyrie is a cartoon.
Right.
We know them in other contexts, and we know they're opera, but we may not know where they are. So that was sort of what I was saying, that you this will ring a bell, perhaps.
Well, and this recording, did you get this off a dusty old LP? Or?
Yeah, this came from an older LP recording.
Really?
Yeah, there's not many recordings out there. This one is, the conductor is Pierre Dervaux of the National L'Opéra Comique with Janina Michaud singing Leila Nadir is the great Nicolas Guedda, which is one reason I use this recording. He is so beautiful in this. And Zurga is sung by Ernest Blanc, the baritone.
So our listeners might forgive us for the old LP fuzzy sound in exchange for a great performance.
Yes, yeah, and well, hopefully there'll be some newer recordings of this. It's not played that often, this opera. It's beginning to come back into the repertoire, but it went through a while where they just played the duet, and actually the tenor aria, which we'll play in a little while. But now when they're getting ready for this festival, the harvesting of the pearls, a boat is seen, and a single woman who's heavily veiled is in the boat, and her little boat approaches the shore. Zurga goes to meet her, and they talk. He invites her ashore and reminds her of her promises and her vows. She must vow that she will pray for the pearl fishers alone. There will be no friend, no lover, no husband. She will not lift her veils, and that her job is to pray for the fishermen.
Because that was basically their only safety net.
Yes, it was, literally, on pain of death. And she vows. But as she's vowing, out of the corner of her eye, she sees Nadir. Nadir she had fallen in love with. And he has not been true. He has come back, and his main purpose in coming back is to find Leila. He knows that this ceremony is happening, and he doesn't know until he arrives that the priestess they had both fallen in love with earlier is, of course, Leila in the opera. So now we're back on the horns of another dilemma with the two men. Nadir recognizes her at this point, and she recognizes him, and she hesitates with her vow. And Zurga says, if you're having second thoughts, it's all right. You know, you don't have to do this. And she says, no, I will do what fate decrees. And we all know it's not going to be good. So she takes her vows, and she. And I'd like to play you a little bit of that section where Zurga is speaking with her, and she makes her vows. And the Zurga here, as I said, is the great Ernest Blanc with Janina Michaud from this rather old recording. Thank you.
Thank you.
That is the point at which Zurga makes Leila vow that she will be true to her vows and pray alone during the harvesting of the pearls. So she agrees and goes off to her rock in some production. She climbs this rock and there's this wonderful romantic figure. You can hear, I think, just in this example, how easy on the ear this music is. It really flows very beautifully and very simply, almost conversationally. We'll talk about this in connection with another opera later on where it's conversational but more difficult. I think the flow is very easy to listen to here.
Well, and of course you have a French composer composing in French, which is not what there are German composers mm-hmm. who compose in Italian and so on, but when it's in your native language, that probably helps, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And if a composer has to present his Italian opera in France, he will often change to the French language. For instance, with Mahometto, it was written as an Italian opera, but eventually it became The Siege of Corinth in French, and it was a completely different production. Verdi did that with a number of his operas. He reworked them for Paris because the Italian version just wouldn't have worked. But they typically do write, of course, they write in their own language. Mozart perhaps was an exception because he composed in both Italian and German. So they write in their own languages. And I think you need to hear the opera in the language in which it is written. The words are written to the sound of the words to the music. It doesn't work in translation, especially in English. And yet the English National Opera in London in the beginning insisted that every single opera would be in English. We get around that, of course, now, Mary Charlotte, with super titles, with the titles on the back of the seat or over the stage, because you get your operas in the original language plus two or three translations. Here at the Santa Fe Opera, you can read them in English or Spanish.
And it's wonderful.
It is. It makes all the difference, I think. Though, again, I always say, you know, it's best to listen to it beforehand, know the story, so you're not depending on those titles for what's going on.
Well, that's if you're the opera fan or fanatic or right. aficionado that many people are. But then a lot of other people, maybe who are listening right now, are going to say, well, I've never been to an opera. Let me go. You go in cold. And that's
right.
a beautiful thing mm-hmm. in itself, because you don't have to have some kind of book in your hand that you're using a pen light to try to figure out what the libretto is.
No.
You've got your subtitles on the chair in front of you. You're watching the opera. It's like mm-hmm. watching a foreign film.
Yes, it is. It's exactly the same thing. And it's made opera very accessible to countless thousands of people who wouldn't have gone before because they didn't understand it.
Yeah.
But having said that, if it's an aria and there's about three lines of text and the aria lasts 10 minutes, as sometimes happens, you have that opportunity of just taking our attention away from the reading.
That opportunity.
Absolutely. And listening to the music. So anyway, now she has gone off to pray, and now Nadia has realized that this is the woman that he loves, and he sings his beautiful aria. Once more I seem to hear, hidden beneath the palms, her soft and sonorous voice, resembling the wood dove song, night of enchantment, divine rapture, lovely memory, all very French and very beautiful, and sung here by Nicolai Gedda. Thank you.
And we're listening to music from the opera The Pearl Fishers by Georges Bizet.
So he cannot stay away from her, of course. This is the tenor.
Nadir.
Yes, he's going to pursue the soprano regardless.
So As these things are.
So she is praying and the people are listening to her song. But as she is singing, she has seen Nadir and she sings of her love for him. The people are not quite sure. They don't realize. They think she's still praying and he is drawn to her. And, of course, they sing the inevitable love duet at this point. And of course, the love duet goes on far too long, and they're captured by the absolutely furious villagers who realize that she has broken her vow.
And she's in danger, having broken her vow, of letting pearl fishermen drown.
Yes, exactly. They believe that. They believe that her prayers are necessary to intercede to the god Brahma for their people to be saved. So it is a life and death issue from where they are coming from. And she realizes, too, she has honor, but Nadir really doesn't. Nadir has betrayed his friend, and now he has put her life and his at risk by seeing her when he knows that he shouldn't. But we all do sometimes things we shouldn't do.
For love.
For love. It's amazing what happened. So let's hear a little of the love duet from the Pearl Fishers.
Est-il vrai que dis-tu nous avons
This is a little snippet from the love duet from the Pearl Fishers.
And we're talking to Desiree Mays, author of Opera Unveiled, talking about Georges Bizet, The Pearl Fishers. And what a beautiful opera.
It is. The music is really beautiful. French opera, it's very melodic. It's a simple story. There's nothing complicated this opera.
Here's the story. Boys meet girl, boys lose girl. One boy gets girl, the other boy gets mad.
Yeah, exactly. And guess which voice gets her?
The baritone always loses. The tenor always wins. Can we just say something about prejudice against baritones?
I know, it's terrible. Though, as you pointed out, you often prefer the baritone.
Given if I were the leading lady, I would take the baritone. Not Scarpia or some of those villains, but I mean, just in terms of the sound of their voices, those baritone voices are so beautiful. Why can't they be the love interest?
I agree. And maybe it's something revealing about you, Mary Charlotte, that they're often the anti-hero or the bad guys.
No, but why should they have to be? Why can't the tenor be the bad guy?
Yes, I agree. And sometimes it happens. Actually, with not so much with this opera, one of the others we'll be talking about with Mametto next week, you'll hear that the father is played by a tenor. Now, we're used to fathers and older people being sung by baritones or bass voices as they get older. But in some of the musical periods, the tenor was sort of a non-event. Going back to the earliest days of opera, they had the castrato, who was a castrated male who kept this very beautiful soprano type of voice. So there were only bass voices then to play these older roles. There were no tenors. Tenors were non-events. And as time moved forwards, the tenor was still not the most important character, because after the castrato, women took those roles. The mezzo-sopranos would sing what were called pants roles.
Which is odd.
which is odd. But it was a convention of the time, and people accepted it.
But they're still doing it today. You've got some of these operas with female mezzo-sopranos playing some girl's boyfriend.
Well, we'll run into it twice in Mameto. The general is sung by a mezzo-soprano. Yeah. And then the day of the tenor finally dawned, and now the tenors are our heroes, and we expect the leading character to be a tenor. But in the Mameto, for instance, he is an older man or a father. But typically, yes, in Verdi operas, the tenor will get the soprano and the baritone will be left in the cold.
I think here in Bizet.
Yeah, yes. Yes, though I think one of the strengths in this opera actually is the wonderful brotherly relationship between these two men. I think that the truest love, certainly from Zerger's point of view, is his brotherly relationship, with absolutely no sexual over or undertones in their relationship. They are truly brothers, and it's the loss of that brotherhood that Zerger more... In fact, at the end, when he loses the girl, he seems to be more upset by the loss of the brother that he thought he had found.
Right.
And that's of a more, more interesting dimension, I think, to the plot, certainly in this plot, which is pretty slim plot. Anyway, at this point, things have got very serious because the crowd, the villagers, the fishermen have discovered that she has broken her vow and that she and Nadir have been caught together. They had just agreed to separate for the night, but they left it too late. So the crowd want them killed. They must be sacrificed to the god because the god now will be displeased. And this is borne out by a terrible storm that arises in the music, of course. And they know that Brahma is angry and the two must pay for their transgression by death. At this moment, Zerger bursts in and he, as their leader, says, "I will take control of this." And first of all, when he sees the two, he attempts to allow them to escape. He doesn't want to kill them. He realizes he's more of an enlightened human being and is not so superstitious. He tries to let them go, but then the wind lifts her veil, and he realizes that this is Layla, the woman that he too had loved. And he is so furious that he turns on them. He said, "Yes, let them both be put to death."
Well, that's not exactly brotherly love, is it?
No, but he's speaking from his heart, off the top of his head, and he does regret it in the next act. But at this point, he does again the human thing. You know, you find that your best friend is dating or carrying on with your beloved.
That's true. You throw him on a pile of fire.
You might shoot him. So it's not too irrational a response. So let's hear a little of this discovery by Zerger that Layla, the priestess, is in fact the woman he too had loved.
Arte, arte. Bravo de fuir à tous, fais-toi connaître. Qu'ai-je vu? C'était elle, ô fureur. Rangez-vous, rangez-moi. Malheur, malheur, malheur sur vous. Malheur. Come on!
And that, of course, is the prayer at the end of this act of the villagers, the fishermen who sing, Brahma, divine Brahma, may your arms protect us. We swear to punish their profane love. O Brahma, save us. So it's a great curtain line at this point. In the next act, then, Zurgo, who is a good man, is having second thoughts. He thought, well, I acted a little rashly in putting them, condemning them both to death. And he mourns the loss of his brother's friendship. And he's distraught about Layla. At that point, she is brought to his tent, and she pleads not just for herself, but for Nadir, which totally infuriates Zurgo again, and he sends her away to be put to death. As she leaves, she hands a fisherman a necklace she's wearing around her neck, and she leaves. And Zurgo goes to the fisherman and takes the necklace and looks at it and recognizes it.
Now, and therein lies a tale.
Therein lies another tale. In the first act, of course, we've been told that Layla will be true to her vows. She believes in truth. She's honorable. And as a child, a man had been pursued by angry people, and he had taken refuge in her house. And she, the child, had kept her mouth shut. She had not revealed his hiding place. And
so she really saved his life.
She saved his life. And the following morning when he left, he gave her a necklace. And lo and behold, it's the same necklace.
And said, wear this always.
Wear this in memory of me, which of course she did.
When you're sleeping, eating, bathing, and she does.
And she does. But now she gives it to a fisherman standing by saying, when I am dead, please send this to my mother. So he realizes what is going on, what has gone on, and Layla is.
And this is the woman who saved his life.
This is the woman who saved his life.
When she was a little bitty child.
Yes. And then this is the woman he fell in love with, and the plot thickens. So I'd like to play a little of you here, the duet between Layla, the soprano, and the baritone, no less. And she says, I am trembling, I stagger. What is there to hope for from this man's cruel soul? A glance from him and I am helpless. From this cruel soul, what have I to hope for? She doesn't realize that this is the Zurgo who had also loved her. And they have this dialogue. Let's hear a little of Zurgo and Layla.
Music from the Pearl Fishers. I have to say, a lot of operas, as well as Shakespeare, rely on people not recognizing each other. So here's a young woman, as a child, she saved this guy's life. Then he falls in love with her, and she doesn't recognize that that's the guy whose life she saved. And then later, they see each other again, still no recognition. The only recognition is the necklace.
Yeah, that's true. Of course, she's heavily veiled at this point, so he's not to know until the tropical breezes move the veils and reveal who she is. And there's something else going on with this, too. I think it's interesting from the audience's point of view, because the audience knows. The audience are let in on the secret as to who she is, even when the character on stage doesn't. That lends another dimension for us in our understanding of the plot and where our sympathies lie, because we may know what's going to happen because we know who Layla is when he still doesn't know. And it's a way of drawing the audience in. And of course, it makes a little more of the weave of the plot a little tighter. So now it looks like things are really bleak and we are going to have a burn returning of the two protagonists at the end of this opera, and the villagers prepare for this. They dance, and here you get the dance. This is a French opera. There's going to be a dance.
Now, let us say here that Desiree Mays was a ballet dancer herself.
Yes,
Desiree,
I was.
and danced basically for operas.
I danced with the Ballet Company in London, yes, and with Sadler's Wells Opera Ballet. Little dreaming that all these years later I'd be talking about it instead of dancing my way through it.
But it must be especially nice for you when these operas contain dance numbers.
Yes. Yeah, in fact, we went through such a dearth of no dance in opera. I mean, it used to be operas were considered to be too long, so the first thing they cut was the ballet. I mean, there were years when ballet was cut completely from opera, and then as a dancer it was always a little tedious being in the opera ballet because the sets were massive and nobody would move any of the heavy set. You had to work your way around it. So there was never a dance space like you get with a ballet company with a bare stage or something that could be moved. So that was always a bit of a problem. Now it is so wonderful that dance is coming back. I mean, this program, Strictly Come Dancing, is that what they call it in this country? That's what it's called in England. The dance program that the entire world is watching. Every country has their own version.
Dancing with the Stars.
Yes, Dancing with the Stars. Dance is coming back. So this is great. And in here we have the dance from the Perfishers as they prepare to sacrifice the two principals. So now the scene is set for the sacrifice of the soprano and the tenor for Leila and Nadir because she has broken her vow to the Perfishers. After the dance, then there is a red light seen in the sky, and Zurga comes on and he tells the people that their village is burning and they have to go and save their children. So they all rush off stage, all except Nurabad. Nurabad is the bass, the character we haven't talked about. He is the high priest, I suppose, who brings Leila, the priestess, to the island, and he is the one who now stands before them, and he is there for the scene. He does not leave. He hides himself and he listens what happens. Zurga turns to Nadir and Leila, and he says, Leila, now you once saved my life with the necklace, and now I will save yours. You must escape. I set the fire. He set the fire so the village would leave so they could escape. They escape, but Nurabad warns the people. He says, Zurga has now betrayed us, so they come pouring back on stage. And there's a marvelous denouement to this opera in that one doesn't quite know how it's all going to come out. As I said, Zurga is an enlightened man. He's been true. He's tried to be true to himself, but
well,
it's very difficult.
How enlightened is it when you keep changing your mind about throwing your best friends onto
the fire?
A
yes,
fire.
Well, now he is saving their lives and they escape. And it was not clear that apparently the original ending by Bizet was lost for a long time.
Oh, is that right?
So directors had sort of a field day. So there's sort of a choice of endings. He can either be stabbed and murdered by the villagers. He can be thrown on the fire instead of Nadir and Leila. Or he can be left to face his destiny, which is a more sort of contemporary ending where the audience knows that he will pay the price. He will offer himself in place of their sacrifice, if you like. But it's not clear quite how that will come out.
But in any case, Nadir and Layla escape.
Yeah. Okay. So those two have a happy ending, and Zurga clearly doesn't. I talked to the director, Lee Blakely, about this, and he said that there are many ways to work this, but he'd rather wait till he came here into the rehearsal process and work it through with his principals.
Oh, interesting.
And let it evolve. This is something, Mary Charlotte, I find more and more talking with production people and with singers, that it is a team effort now. The day of the diva coming in and doing what everybody else had done with Tosca, whatever the opera happened to be, has changed. It is a team effort where they work very closely together, and the dynamics, the drama of the plot can well be worked through with the singers at rehearsal time. So,
let's talk for a moment about the sets. What does this opera look like here in the Santa Fe Opera production?
Exactly. This was something very interesting that, you imagine you're going to be on an island of Ceylon where the pearlfishes are, and that this would be a sort of a primitive place. But in fact, what the director has decided to do, along with the set designer, of course, is to have a giant picture frame on stage. And downstage, this part nearest the audience, is French colonial style, which is the style of the time in which the opera is written. So it was contemporary for the audience. But through the picture frame, you see a desolate, isolated place, a place of dreams, a place of ritual, where this story could in fact have happened. There's a ruined statue of a Hindu deity on one side. So you're seeing, the perspectives are mixed up, but it actually puts it into perspective, I think. You understand we're looking from one place into this fairy tale story. And it's an interesting point of view. In the second act, when the storm has happened and the drama, the crisis has been reached, and Zurga realizes he has lost everything. He's lost his friend, his beloved, and now his people. And there's a devastation. There's a wasteland inside the picture frame. So it's interesting what it does to us, the audience. We are sitting in the audience looking at this sort of French colonial, which already for us is history, not contemporary, and then through the picture frame into the perspective of that village. It's a very interesting set, and one that people should go see. This is an opera to see.
Every year there's always some sets at the Santa Fe Opera that are so creative that you just take such delight in them, as well as the music.
Yes, I agree. And as long as the sets complement the piece, which has been the criticism, of course, of the famous Met Ring at the moment, they have this enormous machine, which is top heavy in every way, shape, and form, creaks loudly, and is on a on a desperate rake that the singers can't handle. That has not been such a success.
Now, there are some other things that we can talk about. First of all, there are family nights that people can attend.
Last year, the opera brought in a new program, which I think is marvelous. In the last week of the season, when the operas have been up and playing, just before they come to an end, you could go on family night. This means you need to round up some kids, preferably your own and their friends. Schools can't do this. Typically, in other opera companies, the schools organize for vast numbers of kids to be exposed to opera, and that's been very successful. But because our opera is when the schools are out in the summer, it's up to families to bring them. But you can bring any number of kids. And actually, it might be really fun to go to a youth night dress rehearsal and then go again to see the opera at the end of the season. It's absolutely riveting, I find, to see how things have not necessarily changed, but come together and tightened from a dress rehearsal to a final one. So those performances, Tosca is on August 18th, and August 21st, The Pearlfishers for Family Night, August 22nd, and Arabella's Family Night is August 23rd. And again, you need to call the box office, 986-5900, to find out what the details are. There's a little note here that says the children must be 6 years of age to attend the performances, which I think is fair enough.
Or older.
Yeah, but all children. All of us can go. But I think this is a wonderful opportunity to introduce young people to opera.
And we're running out of time, but in the last moments we have left, let's hear a little bit from the final trio of the Pearlfishers.
God.
Desiree Mays, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
We've been speaking with Desiree Mays. She is an international speaker on opera. She's the author of the book Opera Unveiled, which comes out every year to accompany the Santa Fe Opera season. She gives the preview lectures nightly at the Santa Fe Opera. For more information on the Santa Fe Opera, you can go to santafeopera.org. You can call 505-986-5900 or 800-280-4654.